This episode of Knife Talk is sponsored by Tormek. For your chance to win a T4 sharpening system, visit knifetalk.net to enter the draw. The winner will be chosen on our 10th show and will receive a Tormek T4 and a set of jigs to make your knives razor sharp. So welcome to the very first episode of Knife Talk. Today I'll be speaking with Walter Sorrells about his life as a professional bladesmith, including his wildly successful YouTube channel, and his way of making these amazing Japanese swords. So hey Walter, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Craig. Good to be here.
Great stuff. So whereabouts in the US are you based?
I'm outside of Atlanta, down in the southeast.
Right, okay. So you've got the sun at the moment then?
Well, a little bit.
So let me try and set the scene a little bit here. So do you have a separate workshop you work from, or do you have a shop at home? What's your kind of setup there?
Yeah, basically I work out of a garage-type setup, but I should be moving to a kind of more extensive place probably in the next, you know, within the next few months.
Yeah, never enough room for the tools, eh?
Not even close.
So many people may know you as a great bladesmith, but you're also a very respected novelist. So from a successful novelist to a highly respected bladesmith, that's not really a normal career path. How did that happen?
Well, yeah, it's definitely. But, you know, starting out as a novelist to begin with is not really your normal career path. So yeah. Once you pile another weird career on top of it, it's just more of the same. But kind of the way that it started was typically, as a writer, I found that, you know, I'd get started in the morning and crank away for a while. And at a certain point, my brain was just kind of squeezed dry. And that when I first got started, I sort of felt like, oh, I should work an 8-hour day and be just like some guy working down at the factory. But I just realized after a couple years of working hard in the morning and then kind of flagellating myself all afternoon for not getting much accomplished, I just realized like the rhythm of being a novelist is not the same as the rhythm of screwing car doors on at the factory or something. And so, you know, basically I would work all morning, and when my brain just stopped functioning, I would quit and try and do something else. And so somewhere along the line, I had an idea for a novel that was going to involve a guy who was a Japanese swordsmith. And so I thought, well, you know, I should do a little research, kind of try and get something tactile, something tangible that I could sort of feel in my hands. Yes. How that character would think. And so I started doing that, and I got the bug, and one thing led to another. And here I am almost 20 years later. Doing this as a full-time thing.
Right. It's a similar story with myself. So I run a publishing company for some time. And that whole thing of sitting in front of a screen for 8-9 hours a day and just needing to make something with my hands, you know? And funnily enough, it was your videos that I came across making knives that got me into making knives. And it sort of blossomed from there. So, yeah, it's a very strange beginning into the industry, but you certainly seem to be doing very well.
Well, I appreciate it.
So from those sort of humble beginnings, when did that become a job? When did that become your main sort of focus?
Well, here's sort of the progress. And, it, you know, there's not really a hard and fast line. But essentially what happened was 10, almost 15 years ago now, I guess, I got to a point where I realized, well, if you want to do Damascus steel, if you want to do folded stuff, you know, my main focus was Japanese swords. And so I wanted to be able to pursue something in that kind of traditional realm, which involved all this folding. And, you know, of course, back in the good old days, you'd have two or three big, healthy young guys who would swing 20 kilo hammers. But that's not practical anymore. So you need a press or a power hammer or something. And I just realized, like, okay, you know, instead of taking that money out of the couch cushions or out of our family, you know, food budget, yeah, I would sell some swords, and that would pay for the tool, you know. And so I put up a little website, and I was actually just kind of shocked at the response that I got. You know, so I what happened was I quickly got orders that put me in a backlog kind of situation for just years and years. And so it just kind of naturally evolved from a thing that I did in the afternoons after I finished writing into something that was more of a full-time business. And honestly, the writing business kind of changed as I went along, and I was just having a lot less fun with it. And the income goes up and down, and there were a lot of things that over time were making me kind of unhappy about writing. And I was enjoying the sword making more, and so I just kind of transitioned slowly into this being my full-time occupation.
Fantastic. And does it feel like a job?
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, you better believe if you're standing in front of a forge in Georgia with no air conditioning in July, it's 110, 120 degrees standing there in front of a forge. And if you think that's not a job, you haven't tried it.
So, that's great. You're in the business, and you've got money coming in. You've got customers and so on. But what was your motivation behind the YouTube channel, which has been wildly successful for you?
Well, again, I've planned absolutely nothing in this business. I had all kinds of plans when I was a writer, but this sword making thing has totally been by a flying by the seat of the pants approach. So here's exactly what happened. I used to get emails constantly from people who would say, "How do you make your hamons?" Because that seemed like something that very early on I sort of was doing in a different way from other people. And so I got endless emails from people wanting me to explain how I did them. And I would answer them at great length for a while. And finally, I realized, first off, you can't tell people this in an email. It's just too complicated. And second, it's just completely unreasonable to try and write, a novel length email to every single joker who wants to find out how I make hamons. So I thought, well, I'll just make a little video. I'll charge like $5 for it, and it'll just shut these guys up, and I won't have to answer all this email. So, being the sort of obsessive guy that I am, I started doing this video, and it ended up becoming much more complicated and much more. I just tried harder to do a good job of it than I had originally intended. So once I got done with it, I realized, like, this is an hour-long video. It's very detailed and blah, blah, blah. I might as well charge more of a reasonable price that reflects, what the work that I put into it. So I did that, and there was a good response to that. And then I did several other videos of a similar sort with other aspects of Japanese sword making. So next thing you know is I sort of have this little catalog of sword videos. And I guess this period was about 10 years ago when YouTube was first coming along. And I thought, oh, here's this YouTube thing that they put videos on. I'll just upload a few little clips here and try and attract attention to my videos so I can sell them off my website. And I just quickly realized, like, this is attracting something different. It's just a different thing. And people are responding to it a little bit differently. And this YouTube thing, it's something different. It's its own little thing. And I just started doing more videos. Again, it was mainly as a self-promotion kind of thing, and it got more and more, momentum. And so I it just kind of slowly grew into this thing, and here it is today.
Well, I've got to say that the production values are fantastic. I mean, there's a lot of crap and sort of misinformation out there on YouTube, but yours are always my go-to resource. If I want to learn to make mosaic pins, there's a Walter video. If I want to learn to, the best way to sharpen a blade, it's a Walter video. It's the go-to place for me,
Well, I'll tell you, there were sort of two sides to that. The first was, especially when we first got started on YouTube, there was a lot of just unbelievably garbage production stuff, you know.
Lots
and
of it,
and yeah. I would try and learn something off a video, and I'd be like, this is a bunch of shit, you know. This guy has spent no time on this. He doesn't understand anything about lighting, about editing, and I would get mad, you know. I'd be like, what the hell is wrong with you? And that sort of drove me to try and be, you know, to do as good a job as I could to transmit the information that I had. And the, you know, the other flip side of that is just what's the nature of the information that you're transmitting. And, you know, I just tried to, like, if I did something, you know, some of the things that I do videos about are things that I really understand really well and I have plenty to say on. But sometimes I'll do things about stuff because I want to learn more about them and I don't really know squat about it, you know. So I'll go out, I'll do a little research. And, you know, so I try to be upfront about the things that I know more about and the things that I know less about. But, you know, in whatever case, I'm always trying to be, to not just talk shit, you know. I'm trying to say something that I, you know, I've actually done a little research and has some grounding in, you know, the way that people, you know, in fact or whatever. Of course, sometimes I screw up and sometimes I put stuff out there that I don't really know what I'm doing, but I try to do that as little as I can.
Yes, yeah, but I think you just made a point, really, of when you're trying to learn something, quite often it's good to sort of put something out there, whether it's a tutorial or whether it's an essay piece or whatever. Yeah, you're certainly going to learn a lot by just by going through that process as well. So, yeah, I certainly see where you're coming from there.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, this is something that I definitely learned from watching some other people. You know, I'm one of those people that I always want to be the guy in the room who knows the most stuff. And that's not necessarily a psychologically attractive thing. You know, I mean, sometimes you learn better by being humble enough to recognize that you just don't know anything.
Yeah.
And you know, I saw some videos, like I watched John Saunders' videos. I don't know if you've watched them, if you're interested in machining.
Yeah.
Right. And he's always really like, well, I'm just trying to kind of figure this out. If you guys have some ideas. And I kind of had this aha moment with him and, you know, some other guys like that. Like, oh, I don't have to come off as the total expert every damn time I do a video. Sometimes I can just say, hey, I don't really know what I'm doing. Do you guys who know something more than I do, can you help me out here? And you know, there's always somebody who knows more than you do about any subject you're going to talk about.
Yeah, so you sort of start the conversation that way. Yeah, yeah. So what's the fascination with Japanese swords? Where does that stem from?
You know, I, like most people who get involved with knives, you know, I think I was that kid who was always, you know, buying a knife and throwing it into a tree in the backyard and was interested in knights and armor and samurai and all that kind of stuff. But as an adult, I got involved in Japanese martial arts, kind of like right after I got out of college.
Right.
And, so, you know, that led me to, training in Japanese swords and various other things. And, you know, so it was always one of those things that was kind of sitting there in front of me, like, oh, this is something I'm really interested in. And so once I sort of had this revelation that, like, oh, I could actually start to make stuff in my garage and aim for this distant thing over here. Of course, you know, the first thing I did when I first started trying to make knives was I tried to make a katana right out of the gate, not knowing anything. And, you know, it was a complete disaster. It was just awful. And not only was it bad, it would just hit you in the face. Like, Walter, you don't know jack. You don't have any clue what you're doing. And clearly this big, complicated, thing is just this is not the place to start. So I backed up and I went way back and started making more kind of Western type knives and, you know, just trying to learn about heat treating and really, really basic stuff. And so I made a whole lot of blades that were just really simple, garbagey kind of things. But each one I was trying to learn something. And so it took me several years before I sort of circled back around and said, okay, I can hit this Japanese thing again. And maybe this time it's not going to be such a complete disaster.
Yes. Yeah. So you've got this line of tactical knives now, which are quite a departure, obviously, from the traditional sword. So how did that come about?
Well, you know, It's somewhat of a piece with the Japanese things in the sense that it kind of derives out of my martial arts interests. But I also got involved in competitive pistol shooting, tactical, you know, pistol type shooting.
Yes, yeah.
Several years back. And, you know, a lot of the guys that I shoot with have an interest in carrying some kind of additional knife. And of course, you know, nobody's carrying a sword around. So I sort of started backing into that as just a little auxiliary thing that I did sort of for fun. But what kind of came along with this was, as I started to wind down as a writer and kind of spin up as a professional bladesmith and you know, and looking at it as like, okay, this is an occupation as opposed to sort of a high paid hobby. Once I sort of started to make that revelation, I had to just come to the realization also that I just couldn't make grown up money making swords. You know, I probably, in all seriousness, I probably have to charge about $20,000 per katana to make just an honest middle class living, because they're just incredibly complex and difficult to make.
Yeah.
And it, you know, I never felt like what I was doing, you know, I wouldn't have paid $20,000 for what I was doing. And I just felt a little weird trying to get other people to pay that much. And I don't really think there's much of, there are just not that many people out there who are willing to pay $20,000 for a modern sword too. So once I kind of came to that place, I was just like, you know what, let's try and move this in the direction of something that's more production oriented. So, you know, we talked earlier about how I was going to be moving to a new place. That's really driven by the Tactics Armory thing, my new line. I mean, the idea is that I'm going to be hiring people and turning it into a production type business, not just, you know, here's Walter sitting around handcrafting all these little things.
Gotcha. I mean, a lot of your most recent videos have involved CNC machinery, haven't they? So I was just
right.
That's sort of helping that transition, I suppose, to a production environment. I see. Yes.
Right, and you know, it's a really, for me, it's a really interesting challenge. You know, there's a certain kind of person who looks at handmade knives and just says, oh, well, handmade is somehow intrinsically better than machine made, or, you know, they're sort of moralistic about it.
Yeah.
And I don't look at it that way. I look at it as, look, how can we make a good product at a given price point? You know, what are the kind of challenges that lie in front of you as a knife maker, as a businessman, just as a human being? Here's this thing. How do I go about conquering that? And once you frame it that way, then there's going to be a different set of tools involved than if I'm trying to handcraft a Japanese sword that's made from folded steel and, you know, all that
Yeah. So with the tactical range, are you finding a bit more of a, I would imagine that the swords are maybe a bit more form-focused over function, maybe? And maybe a tactical range is a bit more sort of function-focused over form. Am I right in thinking that?
No, actually, I would say that my starting point from day one has always, always, always been function first.
Right.
Now, of course, there is a Japanese aesthetic tradition and all that sort of thing. But, I mean, all of the aesthetics of Japanese swords actually grew out of functional and process-related things. And, you know, a lot of collectors, I think, tend to look at them as just art pieces, but they're not. They're weapons.
Yes,
You know, and so that was kind of always my starting point, especially because I started as a martial artist, and, you know, I handled swords before I really was making them. And so, you know, I always felt like, look, if this thing breaks, if it doesn't cut, you know, all that sort of thing, then it's just do over time. It's just, you know, this is something to just throw on the floor and start over.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I love the sheer sort of utility of a blade, really. You know, to me, the beauty comes after. And
exactly. And you know, it's that form, the elegance of a, I don't want to say a correct form, but a form that is functionally pure almost invariably has aesthetic qualities that are quite dramatic and beautiful.
Yeah. And going back to this sort of production environment, I mean, I started making knives, you know, with files, again, copying your videos, your Susan Hand files and so on. So they're very much sort of handmade knives and very much in that sort of makers movement that's happening at the moment, which more and more people are getting into. But then, you know, going from you just using Japanese sharpening stones to using things like a Tormach, the sharpening wheel, you know, so I can get this consistent edge each time. And yeah, I'm also battling with that. When does it stop becoming handmade and when does it become a production knife, you know? I think that's something that I think every maker really has to sort of draw that line where they fit within the scope of a maker, I think.
Absolutely. You know, there are two sides to it. The first is inside yourself, what kind of challenge are you trying to master or face? And what's interesting to you? And if what's interesting to you is making something with nothing but files and charcoal that you made in your backyard out of trees that you cut down with an axe and stuff, you know, I mean, seriously, there are guys who are like that. And if that's what your challenge is, then then you should do that as rigorously and forcefully as you can. And if it's not, then, you know, follow whatever logic makes sense to you. But the other point I would make on that score is just be honest with your customers about what you're doing. And as long as, you know, as long as you don't misrepresent what you're doing, you know, I would never tell somebody that a machine that a blade that I've made, which involves the use of a CNC machine, was somehow, you know, made differently. That's part of what it is.
Yeah. So tell us about your experience with Forged in Fire. I mean, that doesn't air here in Europe, but I have managed to view your episode online, and it seems like a seriously high-pressure environment, that.
It is. And, you know, it was a fun experience. I was a little hesitant to do it in the first place.
And did they reach out to you, or was it something that you approached them with, or?
Yeah, they reached out to me. They had actually contacted me in the first season, and I can't remember exactly what happened. If it was a scheduling conflict or whatever, but I couldn't do it that first season. They ended up calling me back on the third season, I guess it was. And, you know, that time it all worked out. But it's, you know, it's a... There, of course, it's a videotaped entertainment show, and you know, anything that involves videotape, actually nothing involves videotape, but anything that involves videos, you know, is incredibly complicated to make. You have to shoot things over and over, and you have to light things a certain way, and you have to have the right number of cameras and the angles and all this stuff. And so sort of surrounding the contest itself, there are all these retakes and takes of you standing in front of the anvil and staring at the judges, and the judges sitting there awkwardly and staring back at you. And they shoot this stuff endlessly, and the little interviews with you and all that stuff.
Yes.
And that is more a lot of hurry up and wait boredom kind of stuff. But the actual contest itself is extremely for real.
Really?
Once that
So when they start the clock, that's the clock. Is that right?
Damn skippy, and it doesn't go off until the thing's over. Unless there's a medical emergency, they do not stop that clock.
Wowzers. Right.
So what that means, and here's another little fascinating tidbit. For audio reasons, they turn off the air conditioning in the studio. So you got four forges going at, you know, 2,500 degrees or thereabouts.
Yeah.
And, you know, the space is a little smaller than it looks on TV. I mean, it's still a pretty sizable space, but, you know, four forges will fill that air up with hot air really quickly. So it's probably 110 degrees on the set. And when you're actually standing close to a forge, it might be even closer to 120. So you're working in an extremely high-pressure situation as fast, as flat out as humanly possible, in this incredibly high temperature. And I had actually kind of practiced a little bit. I said, let's just see what it's like to, what can I accomplish in 3 hours in my forge? And so I did a couple little projects where I basically just turned a clock on and worked for 3 hours and turned it off. And this was in summertime in Georgia. And the 3 hour stints that I did at home were just nothing like as brutal as the 3 hours on that set up there in Brooklyn. I mean, it was unbelievable. But the other side of it is just, I mean, it's a lot of pressure, because they're literally like 40 people on set, camera guys. They're probably, 8, 12 camera guys. The judges are sitting there watching you the whole time. All the producers and all those guys are watching you, and so you really feel under the microscope, and you don't want to screw it up. And it's
Yes,
just
yeah.
it's a pretty fascinating experience.
Well, from the few episodes that I've seen over the last few days, there's always somebody about to pass out with the heat. So I can totally see how hot it would be there, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, I got done, and I about 2.5 hours into it, and for those who have not seen the show, I kind of got hosed. I don't want to say that, but I did. In all seriousness, I got a challenge that was far more difficult than the other three guys
Yes,
that
certainly
were
was.
there.
Certainly was, yeah.
But I was also, the most experienced guy there, and I just felt like, well, I can't knuckle under here. I've got to just go pedal to the metal the whole way, and try and take this thing. And I got about 2.5 hours in, and I'd been having a whole bunch of trouble getting this billet out of this canister.
Yeah.
So I had to do basically, I had to forge and heat treat and grind the knife in an hour, essentially. About at the 2.5 hour mark, I just realized, like, and I just knew I had a ton of stuff still to do, and I knew it was doable, but I just knew that I couldn't relent for 1 second. And I realized that heat was getting to me, and I was like, man, this is I'm starting to feel this. But I just said, I'm just not going to relent. I'm absolutely keeping the pedal to the firewall until the last second. And that's what I did. And after it was over, I mean, I was so wrung out. The other three guys, actually, some of them looked a little more tired during the filming, but after it was over, I was by far the most worn out guy of the four. I was nearly catatonic, and it took me quite a little while to recover from that
Imagine
first
if you
jump of the show.
Wearing the denim shirt at the same time, how hot you would have been then.
Oh, I know, I know. And I've thought about, some of these guys that are a little more heavy set or whatever, whatever, just like something, or people from really cold climates or whatever. One of the guys that we were shooting with, he lives in Alaska, and I was at least coming from Georgia, where I was used to the heat. But I mean,
Yes.
if you had anything that was going to make heat tough on you, wow. I'm surprised some people haven't just collapsed in there.
Well, it makes for entertaining show anyway, but yeah, as you say, it's an entertainment show, but it is what it is, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm not going to keep you too long, but I'm going to wrap up with a final question, which is you're a huge inspiration to me, the way you share your knowledge and the popularity of your channel and just the beauty of what you make. But who inspires you?
That's a really interesting question. First off, of course, are the, innumerable Japanese swordsmiths who established that tradition 1,000 years ago or whatever. Those guys were doing just extraordinary stuff with the simplest tools. They didn't
Yes.
have power hammers or belt grinders or any of that stuff, and just very, very difficult conditions. And they made these extraordinary things that, from an engineering and an artistic standpoint, I mean, they're beautiful. They do what they're supposed to do. I mean, they're just amazing. So I would say that first, but maybe on a sort of more human level, you know, both of my parents were artists of one sort or another. My dad was a writer and my mom, was a sculptor and painter when I was a kid. She later went on to do some other things, but you know, I sort of grew up in this, creative world.
Yeah.
And I've just always felt like, creativity is something that there's no top to the mountain. You're always, as soon as you do something, you say, oh, that's really pretty cool. Then the next step is to find all the flaws in it and then try and do better on the next thing that you make. And that way you always got a challenge. And so, you know, that it's not that the inspiration is from inside, but the challenge comes from inside. And so I'm always kind of looking at something that I've done and being unsatisfied with it and trying to move on to the next thing.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's maybe a good time to call this a day, but can you tell our listeners where they can purchase your swords, your knives, and where's best to find you online?
Sure. The tactical things that I do, Tactics Armory, are found on tacticsarmory.com. Pretty easy to find. And then you can find my YouTube stuff by just searching for Walter Sorrells, of course, on YouTube. And then finally, my Japanese swords are on waltersorrellsblades.com.
Fantastic stuff. Okay, that's a wrap.